Welcome to the XYZ Experiment Podcast. Today we have Fiona, Luke and myself, obviously, chatting to you, but we are joined by a guest, Sarah. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tash. It's great to be here.
So we are going to have a little bit of a chat about some of the things that you do professionally and your thoughts about travel medicine and diseases and infections and generations and all of those types of things. So as background, Sarah is an infectious diseases doctor and specialises in travel medicine and also does research in infectious diseases and a lot overseas as well. So has a lot to talk about and know about this topic. But to begin with...
So our first question to all our new guests is, what generation do you belong to?
So I'm actually a Xennial, which actually is a term I first heard on your podcast. And as I learned, it's the micro generation between Gen X and Gen Y who experienced an analog childhood and a digital early adulthood.
And do you feel more X or do you feel more millennial?
I really feel like I kind of bridged the two generations.
Yeah, that you can be a bit of both, yeah.
Yeah.
And what's the most Xennial thing about you, do you think?
I think it's that I wear a digital watch with an analog clock face.
That's awesome. That's
because
so true.
I grew up wearing a watch, and when I adopted a digital watch, it just didn't feel right to have the numbers showing.
That is so funny, isn't it?
It's so true, though. It's so true. Well, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I grew up just outside of Wollongong in New South Wales as the eldest of three girls, and I had a really happy childhood close to the beach with a really close-knit family. And we did have a very analog childhood. Like, I remember spending hours reading a physical set of Encyclopedia Britannica books.
Yes.
You know, I was a bit of a geek. You know, it was a really nice upbringing. It was a pretty traditional upbringing. My dad worked full time. My mum ran the household and looked after us. And as a parent myself now, I can see what a tough job that was. But I guess I wanted something different and I really wanted to get out and experience the world. And so when I turned 18, I went interstate to Melbourne for uni. And I've lived most of my life in Melbourne, most of my adult life in Melbourne, apart from some time spent overseas. So I did a gap year where I travelled around the world and spent a lot of time in South America. I did a couple of stints volunteering in different places in the world. And I also spent a couple of years living and working in Darwin in the Northern Territory.
Wow.
I have an amazing family. I'm a mum to three-year-old James and married to the lovely Aaron, who came in to see the setup before going to the aquarium today. And I really love my work. I have, I guess, three hats in my work life. I'm a doctor who sees patients. As Dash said, I specialise in infectious diseases and travel medicine. I also do research in preventing and controlling infections. And I'm an educator of tertiary students and health professionals.
That's a lot of hats to wear.
It is.
You become a GP or a doctor, right?
Mm.
What then made you go into infectious diseases? What was it that you'd seen or heard or you know, to make you go down that path?
I think it was probably my work overseas and the kind of diseases that I saw while I was working there, the very different health conditions, the prevalence of infectious diseases, you know. I felt like my Western medical education hadn't really prepared me for seeing and managing things like malaria and TB. And, you know, I saw some cases of diseases that should be preventable, like tetanus and rabies. And that really kind of fueled my desire to be involved in managing infectious diseases and trying to prevent and control these infections, because they're diseases that disproportionately affect, you know, the most disadvantaged people in our populations, the poorest populations in the world, you know, people of lower socioeconomic status. So I think that I was really driven to try and address those diseases.
So just even a step back from that, did you always know you wanted to be a doctor?
No, not at all. I mean, my parents joke that I used to want to be a post lady because I liked the little motorbike that they rode up and down the road. No, actually, for most of my childhood, I wanted to be a musician. I played the violin growing up and later the viola. And, you know, I wanted to do music really until my violin teacher sat me down one day and said, look, you know, you're a good musician, but you'll never be a soloist because you're not good enough to be a soloist.
Wow.
And she's like, you know, you could sit at the back of an orchestra and teach music and things like that, but it's a hard life. And she said, you're really smart. You could do something else and have music as a hobby. And I remember the time that was absolutely devastating. I felt like she just shot down my ambitions and goals for life. But I think that was probably the best advice she could have given me.
Yeah.
Because probably that lifestyle wouldn't have suited me so well. I'm not the most patient of people, and teaching beginners violin probably wouldn't have been maybe what I was cut out for. And I have managed to keep music as a hobby throughout my kind of professional career. But I sort of went to see the school careers counsellor and talked to some of my teachers and said, you know, what do you think? And they kind of said, well, you have a mix of interest in humanities and interest in science, and you know, maybe medicine would be something for you. It's not something I'd ever thought of before then, but the rest is history.
Going back to talking about infectious diseases, I thought it was really interesting what you were saying about kind of being exposed to patients with conditions that you thought were potentially preventable. Did you find that quite confronting? Did you see these patients in Australia? Was it confronting to see some of those conditions prevalent in different populations and think, wow, I can't believe that this is something that's still occurring?
Yeah, look, the kinds of diseases I was mentioning are things we do sometimes see in Australia, but they're really infrequent. We don't come across them very often. But you go in and work in places like I spent some time working in Timor-Leste, some time working in Peru, and just the burden of those diseases is sort of unbelievable as someone who comes from a Western background, you know, and has had a fairly kind of, I guess, sheltered middle class upbringing. So I think, you know, if we look at a global scale, diseases like malaria and TB are still big infectious killers worldwide. And they don't really come onto most people's radar here in Australia.
Mm.
So, you know, I think that's kind of why I got interested in them. You know, thinking about why is it that these diseases still exist?
Because they can be treated? Is that right?
Yeah. So yeah. I mean, malaria and TB are both very preventable. Yeah. They're both treatable diseases.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have a vaccine for malaria that's widely available in the Western world, but there are some new vaccine candidates that have come out for endemic settings. There's a vaccine for TB that we give to people in childhood that is okay at preventing disease. It's more important in preventing really serious disease in young children, but it probably doesn't completely prevent, or it doesn't completely prevent the disease. But there are a lot of diseases like measles, for instance, where we've got a really good vaccine that's very effective, but we continue to see cases of measles. And partly that's because to prevent measles, we need to maintain really high levels of vaccination in the population, like upwards of 95%. And as soon as our vaccine coverage drops for measles, we're really prone to having outbreaks of disease. And unless, you know, the whole world can maintain high levels of vaccine coverage, you know, until the whole world can maintain those high levels, anywhere is vulnerable.
Is that because it's lack of money, or is it lack of access to these communities? What is it? Or is it attitudes?
Oh, look, I think there's a huge number of factors. You know, we know healthcare costs money, and so, you know, public health decision makers have to make decisions about where they spend their money, what they spend money on. And, you know, it's hard to get investment into many of these diseases that are affecting mainly poorer regions of the world. You know, it's organisations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, you know, WHO support, all those sorts of things that are relied upon in order to fund these sorts of diseases. But I think from the vaccine preventable disease side of things, you know, I think there are inequities in access to vaccines. And there are some organisations that are doing things to address that. But still, we don't have good access to vaccines everywhere in the world. And there's been a really successful global expanded program on immunisation, the EPI, which has actually just recently celebrated its 50th anniversary. And that was established by the World Health Assembly in the 1970s. And really the main reason that that was established was to try and get on top of smallpox, which was the first kind of human disease that we thought there's a possibility of eradicating this disease. And so, you know, the World Health Assembly recommended that all member states, and there was agreement to this, start or maintain a schedule that covered a range of different diseases, including things like diphtheria and measles and smallpox at that time. And that program's expanded over time, and it's been hugely successful in terms of preventing deaths, in terms of reducing rates of infectious diseases that are preventable by vaccines. And over time, we've seen increasing coverage in different parts of the world with those vaccines. But unfortunately, during the COVID pandemic, we saw a decrease in vaccine coverage globally. And that was probably mainly due to disruption to vaccination programs, because countries had to really divert resources away from other diseases and other programs towards managing COVID. And while we did a fairly good job here in Australia of maintaining our vaccine coverage, globally there's been drops in coverage. And that's really concerning for things like measles, where, as I said, we need really high levels of vaccine coverage to prevent outbreaks and to maintain that herd immunity that you might have heard about.
So a few things, I guess, to unpack there. But I'm just thinking, you know, okay, if Australia did quite well in maintaining our vaccine coverage and say, you know, all of our children get the measles vaccination, yet then now COVID is, well, it's not over, but people are travelling and they go to regions where vaccine coverage may not be as high for measles. Can they still contract measles or bring measles back to Australia even though they're vaccinated?
So I think, you know, the generation you belong to affects which diseases you're protected against, either through vaccination or disease exposure. And while our current vaccine schedule in Australia is one of the most comprehensive in the world, it has changed a lot over time. And, you know, kids born today receive vaccinations against many diseases that their parents and their grandparents weren't vaccinated against. I think many people make the mistake that of thinking that their childhood vaccinations provide lifelong protection against all diseases. And while for some diseases, you know, vaccines do give good long-term protection, other diseases we actually need regular boosters to maintain that protection. So, you know, I think the Australian schedule as well is primarily designed to protect against diseases that are common in Australia. And so it doesn't include vaccines for diseases that are prevalent in some other countries. And so that might be things like typhoid and yellow fever and hepatitis A. They're not routinely on our schedule, but they're still ongoing risks in other countries.
Yeah.
And to take the example of measles, to use as an example, so in my grandparents' generation, they all had measles when they were kids. They all experienced measles disease. And so they have long-term protection against measles because of that natural immunity that they got from having the disease in childhood. But my kind of parents' generation and even my generation, often people of sort of that born between the mid-1960s and maybe the mid-1990s may not have been vaccinated as a child, but they also may not have been exposed as a child. Or they may have got one dose of the measles vaccine. So I know when I was born, one dose was on the schedule, and now we give two doses because we know that gives better protection and more long-lasting protection. So there are still a lot of people in Australia who are probably under-vaccinated for measles, and maybe they're not aware of it.
Yeah.
And because measles outbreaks are so uncommon in Australia, then the risk of being exposed is really low. But the kind of global resurgence we've seen of measles in the last few years means that when you travel overseas, you're much more likely to be exposed to measles. And if you bring it back, then you could potentially spread it to other people in the community who are not protected.
Wowzers.
So when a child gets vaccinated today, what vaccinations are they getting in Australia?
So the vaccination schedule in Australia protects against 17 diseases, I think, at last count. So a lot. And I probably will miss some if I list them, but I'll have a crack. So they're diseases like hepatitis B, Haemophilus influenzae, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, which is varicella zoster virus that causes chicken pox and can later cause shingles, polio, pneumococcal, meningococcal disease. So there's a whole lot of different diseases that we're protected against. You know, some of those vaccines were kind of given the childhood schedule and then no further doses are required. But for some of those diseases, protection does wane over time. So, for instance, for something like tetanus, which is a soil-borne disease, so a disease that we're exposed to when we have exposures in the environment, like if you, you know, have a cut yourself in the garden and get some soil into the wound, or you step on a rusty nail or something, the protection from that vaccine wanes over time. And so boosters are recommended if you potentially at risk every 10 years. So it depends on the disease. But I think a really important thing to realise about vaccines is that the more effective they are, the less we see of the diseases that they protect us from. And, you know, people who are my age, you know, we probably had chicken pox as a child, but we certainly didn't get polio or measles. No. But if you talk to people of my grandparents' generation, who I think are from the silent generation, you know, they will have friends or family or people they know or maybe themselves who had measles as a child, who had polio as a child, who know people who had long-term consequences of these things like paralysis or deafness, you know. The doctors who train me will tell stories about the ward that was filled with iron lung machines or ventilators that were used to treat polio patients in like the 1950s and 60s and 70s. So I think we as a society have often forgotten about these diseases. And so we then see this idea of vaccine hesitancy. So this kind of rising concern about vaccine side effects and the consequences of vaccines because we haven't seen the consequences of the diseases. And I'm not saying vaccines are free from side effects. They're not. But I can hand over my heart say that the consequences of the diseases are much, much worse than the side effects from the vaccines.
100%. And I like even remember, like I had malaria as a child. I am living in Nigeria. I had chickenpox as a child and was so unwell with it I thought I was going to die. Like I was nine. I wrote a will. Like I had fevers that were like through the roof and the doctor had to come to our house every day to like look after me because my fever wouldn't break. And yeah, I thought I was literally going to die. So I wrote a will of where my toys were going to go. But so I have these vivid memories and then I remember seeing a meme on Facebook of like a vaccination clinic in Africa with lines of people and everyone being like, it's so important to vaccinate your kids. And then like comparing that to Australia where we don't see those diseases and people are like, oh, I'm choosing not to. And it's just like this interesting dichotomy of what we see and then what we go, what's important to kind of protect against.
I just wanted to touch on that and ask you, Sarah, because not only are you an infectious disease doctor, but you also specialize in travel medicine. And I can imagine that they complement one another. Would you be able to talk to us a little bit about what we mean by travel medicine and how that might impact practice?
So travel medicine is all about keeping people healthy and safe when they travel or cross borders. And so it's not just about tourists, but it's also about people traveling for work, who go to visit their family overseas, who have moved to a new country, like migrants and refugees. And there are different areas of travel medicine. So we talk about, for instance, pre-travel health, which is really preparing travellers for going overseas by giving them advice and vaccines and medications. But it's also providing care for people who get sick or injured during or after a trip. And it's also things like offering healthcare services to migrants, including screening for different diseases. And so in Australia, there are different types of people who would offer travel medicine services, and that include people like GPs. There are some specialised travel clinics, which might be based in the community or in a hospital setting like mine. And in some states and territories, nurses and pharmacists can also give some travel advice and vaccines.
We're protecting the individual and we're also trying to protect our community from when they come back from that holiday.
Yeah.
When they come from overseas. Like I've got a few people who are doctors and dentists from Sri Lanka and India coming to Australia, and they're sitting all their exams at the moment and they're saying to me, oh, I passed my health check as well, you know, and for TB and all that sort of stuff as well, and sort of checking that they're not bringing that into the community as well. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think there's a few things in place, I guess, to try and protect Australia from the introduction of diseases. And so, you know, when we think about how globally connected our world is, I mean, the COVID pandemic was a really good example of that, right? It showed that a disease that's present anywhere can affect all of us everywhere. And so, you know, Australia has some of the strictest biosecurity rules in the world. And we're an island, as we saw during COVID. You know, that can be a blessing and a curse. I mean, the fact that we're an island means that we've been able to keep a lot of diseases out. And so the biosecurity measures that we have are not just at a human level, so thinking about people bringing in diseases. And certainly for people who are newly migrating to Australia, there are some health checks that routinely happen to make sure, for instance, that they don't have active TB. So they'll often get a chest X-ray and a skin test or a blood test to look for evidence of TB. You know, we think about other infections that could be introduced, things like HIV, making sure that people are on appropriate treatment, for instance. But there's also animal biosecurity and agricultural biosecurity to try and, you know, prevent introduction of diseases that could affect our animal industry or our agricultural industry. And, you know, I think we've all had experiences at the airport where we might have to take off shoes that we hiked with in muddy parts of the country to make sure that we're not, you know, carrying any seeds or things that could introduce things into our country. So I think there's that kind of biosecurity element that's always in place with travel.
It's interesting even hearing that because, you know, you mentioned COVID and you mentioned, like, how much that had disrupted, you know, immunization schedules, you know, worldwide, but also like we saw how much it spread globally. And I feel like even since COVID, I don't know, maybe I'm more sensitive to it, but just seeing how quickly infections can spread because of the way people travel, like monkeypox. So that would have never been on my radar like pre-COVID. And then I was like, oh, monkeypox is on our shores. And then the new strain of bird flu. And how that's coming in and just being like, wow, like there's a lot that's happening and just seeing it over the apps and stuff, like go get tested if you were in this location because someone was infected and they were in this location. So it's kind of amazing the systems we have set up now for that.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, outbreaks have always been with us as humans. You know, if you think back through history, there are things like the Black Death and you know, outbreaks that really were incredibly disruptive. You know, the Spanish flu, Spanish influenza in the kind of World War One period. Some of these outbreaks have been incredibly devastating. Huge amounts of the population, you know, have died as a result. But outbreaks are certainly increasing in their frequency. And in some ways, we've improved our abilities to detect them. But in other ways, it's because of our behaviour as human beings. We're encroaching on environments where there are animals. And we know that often outbreaks come because of spillover of diseases from animals into humans. So that was the case for, you know, many of the recent examples that you've cited. So, you know, virus that causes COVID probably came from a reservoir in animals and probably started in bats, but you know, there were contact with markets, live markets and things like that that may have been the first spillover events into humans. Mpox, so we used to call it monkeypox, it's now officially Mpox. But that's another disease that spilled over from animals.
So,
you know, there's this risk as we're encroaching on animal environments, as we're expanding our kind of disruption of the environment, and as we become more globalized, not just in people moving around the world, but, you know, food being transported around the world and animals being transported around the world, there's more risk of outbreaks sort of all the time. And travellers are one of the ways that, that these diseases can get back into Australia.
Wow. Do you think, I'm Generation X, and so my mind goes to the first sort of really infectious diseases I remember, chickenpox, of course, where, if one kid got it at school, we all got it, you know, and it wasn't just a matter of if, it was when everyone got it, and then your brothers and sisters got it, you know, and it was almost like a chickenpox party, you know, everybody gets chickenpox.
Yeah, people would come over to get chickenpox from you.
That was the first thing I remember. But then the next thing I remember for me is the AIDS epidemic. Mm. And that was the first time I ever saw the government really do some massive campaign about an infectious disease. Mm. And probably then the next one for me is COVID. You know, it was a huge gap in between those. Mm. Do you think that's important, like people getting that information, or do you think it's too much? Or I just wonder.
I think we really need to be very careful with our public health messaging. I think we've seen many examples of how that's been done badly and probably few examples of how that's been done well. I think you touched on the AIDS epidemic, and I think that's probably an example of how it was done pretty poorly.
Mm.
I don't know if you remember the ads that
the bowling
aired.
Balls and the so death,
the Grim Reaper.
It's still in my mind. I can see it clearly. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was fear-based messaging, really. So that was, you know, a somewhat effective technique to get people to pay attention.
Mm.
But what it did was it created fear and stigma.
Yeah.
And that was very damaging. And I think we've gotten past that point now. And if you think about, for instance, people living with HIV, I think a lot of the language has changed. So it's much less about talking about an AIDS epidemic or HIV-infected people and much more talking about people living with HIV, because it is an infection that's lifelong. But an infection, if you're on treatment with, you can be undetectable with your viral load and untransmittable. And recently the U equals U campaign, so that's undetectable equals untransmittable, has been a much more positive way to frame, you know, we can actually use treatment as prevention. So people being engaged in care, being on treatment for HIV infection means that actually they can control their viral loads and not transmit to other people.
Mm.
And so I think that's really important messaging. And it's a very different approach to that fear-based approach that we saw during the Grim Reaper campaigns. I think COVID, there were things that were done well and things that were done not so well. And I think the way that the vaccination rollout happened and some of the messaging around vaccination really kind of contributed to some of the hesitancy that we're seeing. And I guess, you know, I hear people talking about, well, the COVID vaccine's not that effective, you know, it's not going to prevent me from spreading the disease. You know, I'm not that much at risk of severe disease. I don't really need it. I think that there are some problems with that thinking. I think, one, we know the vaccine does actually work at reducing severe disease. So it reduces the risk of people getting sick and being hospitalised. And it does help to prevent the disease as well, you know, so it makes people less sick, less likely to go to hospital, which has implications for our healthcare services. It has implications for, I guess, public health in general. And, you know, I think there used to be this mentality that kind of vaccines were black and white, like vaccines just protected you for life and you didn't have to worry about things again. And I think people have now gotten to the point where they understand that there's more grey to it than that. So not all vaccines provide long-term protection. Some of them we need boosters for. And examples of that are things like flu and COVID, where we need regular boosters to maintain our immunity.
And because there's different strains.
Yeah, and because there's different strains circulating. And so we know that, you know, there's new strains of COVID, which means that the earlier vaccines are no longer so effective. And in the same way that, you know, every year the strains that are in the flu vaccine are evaluated and sometimes change, I think we'll see that, you know, year on year, as we get used to this kind of regular COVID vaccine, that the strains will change to match what's circulating in the world.
I think you brought up a really interesting point about the black and white idea around vaccination, because I know growing up, and even, you know, in my adulthood, people would say things like, well, I got the flu vac, but I still got the flu, and so therefore the flu vac doesn't work. And I think it was only when COVID happened, the greyness of going, it's not about you necessarily not ever getting that disease, it's about protecting you against the severity of disease. And that's the element that we're trying to prevent death or severe disease. And so maybe COVID was good for that.
Yeah.
But do you think there's been an increase in vaccine hesitancy for all vaccinations post-COVID?
I do actually think that people have become more hesitant about vaccines. And I think it kind of started around the COVID vaccine, and people have maybe generalised it to other vaccines. And I think that's really concerning. Like I said, diseases like measles, we need to be maintaining really high levels of coverage in the population in order to prevent outbreaks. And I think that really that's being undermined. We did a survey back in December 2022 that looked at people's confidence in vaccines. And we found that actually, compared to previous surveys conducted both before and during the early stages of the pandemic, vaccine confidence had dropped in the general population. And that was mainly in the domains of vaccine safety and vaccine effectiveness. So I think that kind of mirrors what I was talking about, that people kind of realised that not all vaccines are equally effective. And there were obviously some safety concerns around some of the COVID vaccines. I think also how quickly the COVID vaccines were developed and rolled out made people a bit nervous. Even though all of the, you know, regulatory steps were followed, it happened in a much, much shorter time frame than has happened for any other vaccine preventable diseases that we've seen in the past. And so, you know, there wasn't that phase of kind of living with the vaccine and understanding the vaccine and normalising the vaccine that's happened for other vaccine preventable diseases. And I think that's perhaps part of the problem.
Mm.
Can I go back to something else as well in a generational lens? And I'm really keen to know what Luke and Dash think as well, just a little story with it. So growing up in the HIV era, condoms became huge in my era for all sexually transmitted diseases, and very important in sex and all that sort of stuff. And then a few years ago, one of my staff members came to me and she said, look, I'm pregnant after a one-night stand and I need some time off. And it wasn't so much that she was pregnant that blew my mind. It was the fact that she didn't use a condom. And I'd said to her, but what about the other diseases? I actually thought that. I thought gonorrhea, syphilis, you know, HIV. Just that was my immediate thought, because that's how I was brought up in my teenage years. And she was like, oh, no, Fiona, we've got vaccines. Like, we've got cures for those. I'm not too worried about that. And it blew my mind. She'd be a millennial. It blew my mind that that wasn't a worry for her. And I just wonder, are we finding that in the younger generations? I'm really fascinated by that.
Luke, are you worried about?
I'm not, at least in the people in my circles, I'm not too worried, because everyone is super, super conscious of that. And that philosophy of not just about practicing safe sex to like avoid pregnancy, but also like to mitigate diseases. I think that's something that at least the people that I talk to about, they're super, super conscious about that.
Interesting.
What do you find in your profession?
Yeah, so look, I think it's a really great point. And I think as a society, we tend to prioritise treatment over prevention.
Uh-huh.
I think you can see that across all sorts of things. You know, like we think about, you know, when people catch a cold, they often go to see their GP and they say, I want some antibiotics.
Yeah.
Even though we know antibiotics don't work against viruses, and most colds are
a
caused
virus?
By viruses, you know, people want that kind of quick fix. And I think anything that's going to, you know, affect someone's enjoyment of something, like any kind of preventive measure that's going to affect enjoyment, like condoms being an example, you know, people kind of think, well, you know, if something happens, I can treat it. I can fix it. So it's not a problem. And I think, you know, there was a period with the AIDS epidemic, you know, where HIV was essentially a death sentence at the start, that there was a lot of fear in the community. There was a lot of people practicing abstinence or people, you know, being very conscious and using a condom all the time. But as, you know, HIV infections become treatable and we're now in a position where it's no longer a death sentence, I think behaviour has shifted the other way, where people are a little bit less wary. I mean, we know that with travellers, for instance, that a lot of travellers have casual sex and, you know, up to 50% of the time they don't wear a condom. I think it's one of those things where maybe it's situational, you know, or maybe it's just because they're not so worried about it.
Or people going overseas to get tattoos.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that the risk of hep too. C.
Yeah. I think there's also this idea of risk perception. So people often don't see their behaviour as being risky. And I find it interesting in my clinical practice that sometimes I'll see someone and so they come to see me because they're going on a trip to India. Yeah. And in their minds, that is a risky destination. So they think, okay, I'm going to India. I need to see someone about that because they've heard about, you know, typhoid or hepatitis A or malaria, or they're thinking, you know, they need to make sure that they're protected against those diseases. But then I talk to them about, well, probably the most common infections they're likely to encounter are traveler's diarrhea and influenza or COVID. But they don't want to have their flu or COVID boosters because they're not so worried about those infections. They do want to have their hep A and typhoid vaccines. And then when I talk to them, it turns out, you know, they went to Bali, you know, a couple of years ago. They didn't think to come and see someone about their travel health before going to Bali because, like, I think most Australians sort of see Bali as a, you know,
an extension of Australia.
Of Australia. But realistically, the health risks in Bali are not that different to the health risks in India. So it's a really interesting thing. Everyone has different risk perception, and sometimes, you know, I think people don't see their behaviour as being risky or don't see a certain destination as being risky.
Mm. Mm.
Do you see in different patients from, you know, different generations, I guess, patterns in that, not only in the sense of why they're travelling, whether that be for a holiday or to actually go out and experience different cultures, and do you kind of notice as a result of that an awareness about things like preventative measures?
I think there are definitely generational differences, both in the way people approach travel and the kind of things they do during travel. And probably most of what we know about, I guess, generational patterns of travel comes from the tourism industry. But, you know, for instance, boomers have more time and possibly more money to travel than other generations, and so they often tend to take longer trips. They often do a mix of domestic and international travel because I guess some of them have family responsibilities and so on. But they'll often go on those kind of wanderlust type trips that they missed out on, like during the pandemic or maybe while they were raising their kids. And then Gen X, I think they tend to favour domestic travel mostly, again, probably because of work and family responsibilities. And they're often taking, I guess, relaxing family-oriented trips. And they often are looking for deals online because, you know, it's expensive, particularly if you've got a family.
Yeah.
Millennials tend to probably be going for couple or family-focused trips that include things like arts and culture, like museums and so on. And they're also seeking relaxation from their busy lives. I think Gen Z are probably the most adventurous in terms of wanting to go internationally and off the beaten path. But something I think really interesting about a Gen Z is that social media really heavily influences what they do.
Yeah.
And so a lot of them are kind of seeking that Instagram post, or they've seen an Instagram post and they want to get a photo at the same spot, or they're crossing things off their wish list. And I think they're probably the ones who are more likely to take risks, although, you know, I think anyone of any age can potentially take risks. One of the really interesting travel trends I think of this year Is that cruise travel is more popular than ever.
What?
Seriously?
Yeah. That shocks me.
It shocks me
that's
too.
That's so interesting.
That's the one thing that all I can think is of infectious diseases.
Wow,
yeah.
Cruise that's ship. The thing. Seriously. You know, during the COVID pandemic, we saw massive outbreaks of COVID on cruise ships. And the cruise industry, I mean, was decimated during COVID and it looked like they might not recover. But it's bounced back hugely, and not just amongst, I guess, who we think of the older adults who want to go on cruises, but actually amongst the younger demographic. And, you know, the tourism magazines sort of seem to think that this is because living costs are so high and, you know, international flights are expensive as well. And so cruises have this kind of all-inclusive package deal, and they've, you know, priced them pretty low to try and get back I guess, the market after COVID. So that's something that's really taken off. And, of course, you know, cruise ships are an environment where you bring a lot of people together in pretty close proximity. And so there's definitely a risk of things like outbreaks of gastro and outbreaks of respiratory infections like flu and COVID in that environment. And, you know, the cruisers know that, and so they generally have lots of hand sanitizer out and about, but that's not always enough.
No.
I can see why people would go, particularly like I've had a few friends who've done Disney cruises recently because the kids are taken care of and the parents can just relax, you know what I mean? Like I can see. And they feel like the kids are in a really safe environment and so they can really relax. But
and I wonder if to some extent that sort of people have decision fatigue. You know, we live in this environment where we're constantly kind of making decisions all the time and we're constantly, you know, being in demand, and so they just want something where they can switch off and not have to think about anything, not have to plan anything, just sort of rock up. And
so if you were to take a cruise, then you should have your flu shot, you should
have your COVID shot,
your COVID shot. Yeah.
Those are the shots you need to definitely have, because that's what you're gonna get. I often think you know, like, oh, I'm going to Europe, I don't need to do any travel stuff, you know what I mean, like travel vaccinations or I find it's very country focused for me. But now when you said like Bali and then India, not much different, I just think, oh, okay.
Look, I do think there are different levels of risk. And so when we go to a place like the US or to the UK or to Western Europe where the health risks are probably pretty similar to at home, then we don't tend to think about travel advice so much. But I do think there are some really important things to think about. So firstly, as I said, you know, things like COVID and flu are a risk, so getting your booster doses for those would be an important thing to do. And also we know that not everyone is kind of still protected from their childhood vaccinations, so you might need to get a tetanus booster. I think also, you know, you might need to update things like your measles protection. So like I said, the people like me who only had one dose as a child, I've been boosted because I work in healthcare, but there might be other people of my age who haven't had their booster dose, might want to do that before their travel. And there's things to think about like travel insurance and if you've got underlying health conditions, about taking medication overseas and so on. So it's always a good idea, I think, to see your doctor and mention that you're going overseas. You know, for some destinations, there are additional risks to think about. Like if you're going to places in Africa, you probably need to think about things like, is there malaria risk at your destination? Do I need to be taking malaria tablets? But I think, you know, it's not always safe to assume that you're protected from those childhood vaccines.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought about the childhood vaccines for a long time. And then I've got a sister who's very, very a lot younger than me and had a child. And she just said to us older girls, before you come, I want you to make sure your vaccines are all up to date. So it was like, oh, wow, you know. So went and had diphtheria and the whooping cough. And then they said, let's do your tetanus. It's all as one shot. It's like, oh, okay. But, yeah, I thought that was really interesting. And she's not the only one. Like a few times I've gone to see people's children, they just go, oh, are all your vaccines up to date? And I'm like, yeah, all up to date, you know. But then also that, don't really kiss the baby or touch the baby too much either. You know what I mean? Like, not just so aware of that now, just so aware, yeah. And that's where I've sort of had my reminder to have my booster is they're the reminders, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, as part of my course, I'm going to be working in a clinic, and so I had to make sure that I had all of my immunizations. And it's really interesting because coming from Gen Z, there is that assumption. Like, I think that we're quite, we kind of embrace that idea of being immunized, again, at least in the circles that I run in. But it was really interesting when I went to go get my serology done that I was expecting it to be pretty good because I'm pretty up to date with getting different vaccinations. But I was born in the UK, and in 1998, I don't think it was mandatory that you get Hep B shots. And so I actually had no immunization for that whatsoever. And I was thinking, wow, it's so interesting that like only in that short period of time, how much has changed. Because like for me, I was quite shocked. I was like, how is that even possible? But my GP was like, yeah, that's, you know, it was just like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think in Australia, we've got the Australian Immunisation Register, which is, you know, a place where you can see your vaccination records and you can access it through MyGov. And that's actually only been in place since 1997. So we only started documenting childhood vaccinations there. So if you're born before 1997, the only vaccine records you'll have are the paper handheld ones that were given to your parents, which my parents have lost. So.
Yeah.
but, you know, I think adult vaccinations weren't actually compulsory to put onto that register. In fact, it wasn't even possible to put adult vaccinations onto that register until about 2016. And only during the COVID pandemic did it become compulsory to put COVID vaccinations on there. So there, while it's great to have those kind of digital records, they are quite incomplete. And so, you know, we often need to dig up people's childhood records and other things to see what they've had. And often when we do blood tests to look at people's immunity, so Luke mentioned serology, which is really looking for antibodies in someone's blood, we do sometimes find that there are gaps in their protection against diseases like measles and hepatitis B. So
if we've got people who are hesitant about vaccinations for their children nowadays, so the children don't have vaccinations and the kids get older and they become their own decision makers and they want to get the vaccines, what does that mean for them? Can they get it? Is there any difference to their immunity? What happens for them? You know, I get to 18 and I go, I want those vaccines. I want to have those. What does that mean for them?
Yeah, so it is possible to start the vaccination schedule at any time. Okay. The reason that it happens in childhood is we want to try and catch people before they get exposed to many of these diseases, as early as possible. And, you know, there are some things that the people who make the vaccine schedules have to weigh up. So, you know, the older you are, generally the better you'll respond to a vaccine.
Okay.
And
okay.
So the younger you vaccinate someone, this is a generalisation, but yeah, the younger you vaccinate someone, the more doses you usually will need to give.
Yeah. With a vaccine in Australia, if you don't have certain vaccines, does that stop you from being able to have certain careers and things like that?
There are very few vaccines that are actually mandatory or that there are rules around. So as an example, you know, I guess during the COVID pandemic, we did have COVID vaccines made mandatory in order to work in certain professions. We generally would expect all healthcare professionals to be protected against diseases like hepatitis B, measles, mumps, rubella. And the reason for that is both for their own protection, because they might be exposed to patients with those diseases, but also to protect, you know, some of our more vulnerable patients from getting infected. And so although COVID and influenza aren't compulsory in healthcare workers, they're very strongly encouraged. And, you know, there are, I guess, discussions around whether we should make those vaccines kind of key performance indicators for our healthcare workforce so that, you know, healthcare facilities should be trying to maintain high levels of those vaccines amongst our healthcare workers. From a travel perspective, really the main vaccine we think about in terms of requirements is yellow fever vaccines.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, that's a biosecurity thing. So to go to certain countries or to return from certain countries, you may need to show a certificate to say you've been vaccinated against yellow fever vaccine, against the disease yellow fever. And that can be a problem for some of our immunocompromised patients because the yellow fever vaccine is a live vaccine. So it's a disease for which we've only got one type of vaccine, and it contains a weakened form of the virus that causes the disease, which provides a really great immune response. It's one of the vaccines for which, for most people, they get a lifelong response to the vaccine. But it's a vaccine that we can't safely give to people who are on immunosuppressive therapy.
Wow. I just wanted to go back because even that, like talking about, okay, you might need a yellow fever vaccine and, you know, where people might come see you as a travel medicine doctor, what time frame from travel should they come visit you considering they might need to get vaccinated against quite a few different things?
So we generally recommend that people come to see someone about their travel at least 4 to 6 weeks before their trip.
Wow.
And that's because if they do need vaccines, sometimes they'll need multiple doses of vaccines. There might be, you know, other things to consider. And we want to try and maximise people's protection against any diseases they need to be vaccinated against. So something like yellow fever, you have to have that at least 10 days before you enter into a risk area. For people who have other considerations, so particularly people who are immunosuppressed, we might actually consider getting them to come in even earlier than that, you know, to give advice, because it might not just be about the advice to give about the risks on their trip. It might also be there might be adjustments they might need to make to their itinerary, for instance, you know, with something like yellow fever where they can't be vaccinated against the disease. We might advise that they try and avoid kind of high-risk yellow fever areas. I've talked a lot about vaccine-preventable diseases, and I don't want to put the message across that that's all travel medicine is about. It's what I'm most interested about because of my background as an infectious diseases physician. But, you know, there are many non-infectious risks to consider. So things like accidents and injuries, insect bites and stings, you know, extreme temperatures, mental health challenges, crime, altitude sickness, all of those things are part of the kind of travel medicine brief.
And so you would have conversations with your patients about that?
Yes.
Yeah. We were just talking off mic about Michael Mosley and extreme heat and how some of the tourist locations in Greece have now been shut down because it's so hot that they don't want a repeat situation. I was just like, wow, yeah, that would have not been on people's radar that you could die potentially.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's stories like that in the media that we see that make us realise what the risks of travel can be. I mean, you've all probably also seen stories of people having scooter crashes in Bali.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons why it's so important to have travel health insurance that covers things that you're doing while you're travelling. And, you know, as morbid as it sounds, you also want to have repatriation insurance. So, you know, insurance to cover you if something were to happen overseas that meant you had to be flown back to Australia.
Or
if you died overseas, you know, that your remains could come back to Australia. Those things are really important because the costs of healthcare overseas can be really high.
Mm-hmm.
The cost to get you back is really high.
Absolutely.
I've got to say, and I don't know if you're the same, Dash, but I'm an immunosuppressed person, been a type 1 diabetic, and so I've come to the realisation there's a lot of countries I'll never see, you know, because I just think the risk is too high for me in some of those situations and I can't look after my health well enough in that sort of situation. Do you find people say that? But I have thought, oh, I'm never going to get there.
Yeah, look, I think, again, everyone's risk tolerance is different. So, you know, some people like to go skydiving and other people are scared crossing the road. I think it does come down a bit to your risk tolerance.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there are varying degrees of safety for a lot of things. So, you know, certainly if you're immunocompromised, there is an increased risk of the consequences from some diseases. You need to also think about if you have any underlying health conditions, what the kind of medical facilities and, you know, services that you can access in a country are. And so I think they're important considerations. I mean, increasingly we're seeing people who have chronic health conditions who are really well controlled on medications. So examples would be things like autoimmune diseases where people are on these biologic agents that really mean that they don't have any symptoms of their underlying diseases and they really want to travel. And I'm kind of very much pro-travel. I love travelling myself and I think everyone should have the opportunity to travel. But you always need to take into consideration what are the healthcare facilities like where I'm going, how will I be able to access care? Yeah. So you need to think about things like how remote will I be?
Yeah.
And what impact might that have? Mm. You need to make sure you have plenty of your medication supply, you know, in case you have trip delays that mean, you know, you don't run out. If you're on insulin or other drugs that, you know, have considerations around the temperature they can be at, you need to think about. So there's a lot more to think about, definitely. Mm. And it may be that, you know, some of those, I guess, low and middle income countries where the healthcare systems are not as robust may not be the kind of risk that you want to take.
Mm.
But there are certainly lots of amazing trips that you can still do.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Just thinking about the travel insurance, and I know we're not, that's not your specialty, but...
We don't get insured.
You don't?
No, I can't get insured.
Oh, I can get insured. But, like, it amazes me how people just don't give their full medical history or they don't put down they're going to ride a scooter or they're going to do paragliding.
They might not know that at the time.
But just, like, get the right insurance.
Yeah, it's 100%
So you're covered. So you're covered, you know.
Oh, yeah. I think it is very important to be upfront about your really medical history with the insurer because the reality is, you know, if you have a problem that's associated with your underlying condition, the insurer might not cover it if you haven't stated it up front. There are a lot of exclusions to travel health insurance, and I think, you know, I, like many people, don't always read the fine print, but, you know, things like riding a scooter might not be covered, so you might need to take out extra cover.
Mm.
Things like going skiing or snowboarding might not be covered.
And if you have an accident while you were drinking.
Absolutely. If you have an accident while you're under the influence of alcohol.
Yeah.
And even if you weren't drunk.
Even if you weren't drunk. But if, you know, if someone at the hospital you're at does a blood alcohol test and shows that you've got alcohol in your system and you had a fall or an accident, that might not be covered. So you have to be really careful.
Because I know this sounds really silly, but we were looking with a trip to Japan this year and we did all our insurance and I did all my full health, no worries, yep, here's your insurance. A little bit more, of course. But then friends of mine were saying, oh, let's do the Mario Kart scooter thing that goes through the, you know, Tokyo. And I was like, no, I'm not insured for that.
Yeah.
I think if we have an accident, I won't be insured for that. So no, which to them was just ridiculous to say, it's only a fun thing. And I'm going, yeah, but I'm pretty sure that if I have a crash, I'm not insured.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's right. You know, there's something about travel that changes the way we think, whether it's because we're out of our usual environment or because we feel anonymous, you know, the people who we usually worry about judging us are not around.
Exactly.
Yeah, people do make different decisions when they travel. They take more risks when they travel. You know, it's that, you know, YOLO thing.
Yeah.
I only live once, you know. You're like, I'm never going to be here again and I'm never going to get a chance to do this again.
Yeah.
So why don't, and I'm, you know, I'm certainly someone who's, you know, I went hang gliding over Rio de Janeiro because I'm like, that's amazing. Why wouldn't you do that? But you do take more risks
when you
travel. So
especially when you're younger too, I think. Yeah. Like I did a lot of that stuff in New Zealand and my husband now, he always goes, I can't believe you did that. I think, I can't believe I did that. But exactly what you say, hang gliding, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I think this has been a very insightful episode, so much to think about and ponder. Was there anything else you wanted to share with our listeners? Because I felt like we covered a lot of ground, but I know travel medicine and infectious diseases is big, so.
It is a big topic. Look, I think, you know, there's a lot of information out there and we know a lot of people now go to the internet for their health information.
Yes. Dr. Google.
Yeah. And, yeah, there's some great information out there, but there's also a lot of misinformation out there.
Yeah.
So I would encourage anyone who's planning to travel to make an appointment with their trusted healthcare provider, whether that's your GP or someone else, to discuss their travel plans. And, you know, if your usual provider's in doubt, then, you know, there are specialised travel clinics and other places that you can come to get advice. I think, you know, all Australians who are going overseas should look at the Smart Traveller website. So that's the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade website. It is sort of a one-stop shop for travel information. There's a lot of information in there about safety and security overseas. You can have a look at what the current advisory is for each country you're going to. You can subscribe to updates when anything changes in the country so that you'll know. You know, we're working in my group to make some more online resources for travellers.
Amazing.
So we're working at making some vaccine support vaccine decision support tools, and we're hoping that our first one will go online next month. So, you know, I think increasingly that there's good information out there, but people should also be talking to their health professionals about what the risks are and making sure they're up to date with all their routine vaccinations, as well as thinking about things that might be specific risks for their trip.
Hey guys, it's Luke here. Thanks so much for listening to the XYZ Experiment podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a like, follow, and tell your friends and family about us.